Good morning, everyone. This is Reva Winkler from the National Quality Forum. This morning, this is a meeting of the GI Biliary Technical Advisory Panel for NQF's Patients Outcomes Project. We will be evaluating the sub-criteria for several measures this morning to assist the project steering committee in making recommendations. I'd like to just mention a couple basic housekeeping things to start out with. This conference call is being recorded, and the recording will be posted on NQF's website for public viewing, so it's important everybody's aware that you are on the record at all times. This call is set up as a moderated conference call. The TAP will have its discussion on the speaker side. There are audience members that are certainly welcome to listen in. At the end of the meeting, we will open up all the lines for any public comment or questions that might be asked. Also, we are using a webinar to display the slide sets that we'll be talking about a little bit later, as well as the major information as we go through things. So I believe that's kind of the nuts and bolts of how this call is organized. Thank you, everyone, for being here. And at this time, I'd like to turn it over to the TAP chair, Dr. David Johnson, where we will introduce the members of the TAP. David?
Well, thanks, Reva. Welcome to all. It's a little bit awkward to try and do all this by a conference call, but I think everybody probably appreciates the ability to do this in 3 hours and not have a whole day to look at just five measures. So I think that's the intent, is to keep it focused. And what I'm going to ask you to do is we probably all will be very facile with voice recognition in just a matter of a couple minutes, but because the call is being recorded, and the listeners may not know who's making the comments, I'm going to suggest that each time you make a comment, if we don't introduce you as the commenter, to please just restate your name and just kind of re-edify everybody who you are, so we can keep that in context where the comments are coming from. I will tell you that also there is, just to, before we go through this, that we're really going to ask for your full disclosure. You've been selected and really have gone through a conflict of interest disclosure already, but just so everybody's clear that the disclosures for this, really the only thing that would preclude you from being an active TAP member would be to be a participant in the measure development process that you are directly involved. So if that is the case, if you could please make sure that that's disclosed. But otherwise, I'd like to have you give us a little bit of background on yourself, so we can kind of walk around the room, if you will, and then give us a brief also in any disclosure societies that you represent or societies that you're involved with that may have some interest in the measure. So let me start, and first to thank everybody for being here, because I know it's your private time and we're all busy, and you've given up some time to invest in quality recognition, and the NQF is really the agency for quality, so we're really all tied to this as being an important project for our members and our patients. I will begin by telling you I'm David Johnson. I'm a professor of medicine, chief of gastroenterology at Eastern Virginia Medical School. I am a clinical gastroenterologist. I've been a gastroenterologist for over 25 years. I have a full-time academic appointment, but I have a full-time busy private practice and engaged in all aspects of gastroenterology. I've had a longstanding involvement in the GI societies, and I'm the former past president of the American College of Gastroenterology, and have been involved in NQF TAP panels before, so I'm familiar with the process. I have no real disclosures other than the involvements in my society, so that I will leave. And let me take this in a little bit of an order that I'm going to ask you to present, because I've tried to group these in a way that we can potentially allow the flow to be a little bit better. I'm going to ask Brian Jacobson to introduce himself first, and then we'll go from there to the next discussant. Brian, can you give us a little bit of background on yourself?
Sure. Thanks, David. So this is Brian Jacobson. I'm a gastroenterologist on faculty at Boston Medical Center. an associate professor of medicine at Boston University School of Medicine, and I think I'm here representing the American Society for Gastrointestinal Endoscopy, which had nominated me for an earlier GI TAP that I had served on, also with Dave. For that society, I'm currently the chair of their Health and Public Policy Committee, but I've also been involved with a quality task force in the development of GI measures for the use during endoscopy, including some measures that went through the AMA's PCPI process and are currently AQA adopted. For disclosure, I have no link to the measures that we're discussing today. And that should be it.
Great. Thanks, Brian. Dick, I'll ask you to go next because I'm going to group the two measures you and Brian are going to be the primary reviewer on, but just to keep this in the order of what we're going to discuss. So, Dick Johannes.
Thanks. Thank you. This is Dick Johannes. I am also a gastroenterologist, Hopkins trained. I spent the first half of my career in full-time academics at Johns Hopkins. And for the past 10 years, I've been a vice president for clinical research for Care Fusion. And in that role, I am the voting NQF member for Care Fusion. I still maintain a part-time faculty appointment at Harvard Medical School, practicing at Brigham and Women's Hospital in the GI division. My background is that for those past 10 years, I have been responsible for the data definitions and risk adjustment methodologies used for the public reporting of outcomes in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. I have served on several NQF TAPs and one steering committee.
Great. Thanks, Dick. John Allen, have you joined yet?
I have, yes.
Great. Welcome.
Thank you, David. This is John Allen. I am a practicing gastroenterologist in Minneapolis, head of one of the larger GI groups in the country. I'm also on the board of the governing board of the AGA, and I'm just past chair of the clinical practice committee of the AGA, and currently chair the effort to establish the Digestive Health Outcomes Registry. This is my first NQF TAP, but I've been heavily involved in these efforts in other venues. I'm also an associate professor at the University of Minnesota, and I'm aware of the bariatric measures because I have worked with Kay Schwebke at InGenics and given some technical advice around them, but it's been relatively limited. Otherwise, I would have no other disclosures, and I don't really have a commitment to those measures either.
Thanks, John. Karen Hall.
Hi, my name is Karen Hall. I'm an associate professor at the University of Michigan, and I also have an appointment at the Ann Arbor VA. I'm a geriatrician and gastroenterologist, and I combine both primary care geriatrics and gastroenterology outpatient care. I've been involved in the American Geriatric Society and the American Gastroenterological Association for a long time, and I represent both of those organizations on committees. I have a very strong interest in quality improvement. I sit on internal committees at the U of M, charged with that, and I also have done some national service representing the AGS on Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, hiatal hernia, GERD work group, and other quality improvement groups. And I have no disclosures to disclose. I have no interest or connection with the measure that I'm going to be reviewing.
Great. And Rocco Riccardi.
Hi, Rocco Riccardi. I'm a colorectal surgeon at the Leahy Clinic. I've been here for a couple of years. Prior to that, I was at the University of Minnesota on staff there. I'm with the American Society of Colorectal Surgeons on a number of committees and groups there. I have a research interest in quality improvement. I'm the surgeon champion here. I just became the surgeon champion here at Leahy for the National Surgical Quality Improvement Program. This is my first NQF TAP call. and I don't have any disclosures that would be relevant.
Great. Boy, we have a bunch of people that are familiar with snow, and global warming isn't working north of Virginia, I guess. I think that's the I'm the southerner, I guess, for this call. Reva, maybe we could introduce the NQF staff that are on the call as well.
I think there's some other people. I'm Reva Winkler. I'm a project consultant with NQF, and I have been for 9 years. Running our webinar is Sarah Fanta, and Sarah is one of our research assistants. And Heidi, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is Heidi Bosley. I am new to NQF, senior director in the performance measures area. Some of you may have known me. I was with the PCPI for many years, but have now joined NQF. And I'm sorry, Reva, I don't know if you saw, I am going to have to step off at some point, but I'm excited to hear how the results of this panel go.
Great. Thank you. So that's everybody from NQF. Dr. Johnson, we also have invited measure developers to be on the call, to be available to the TAP. If there are any questions or clarifications needed. And I know that Dr. Kay Schwebke is here from Ingenix. And are there any of the other measure developers on the line? Okay, well.
This is actually, this is Jeffrey Geppert from the ARC-QI.
Okay, great. Yeah. Thank you. Anyone else? All right. So I think that's it for introductions, Dr. Johnson.
Thanks, Reva. Let me just go through the process of how we're going to address this. I'm going to turn this over to Reva in a second to give us a little overview on NQF, and those that have been involved will be somewhat familiar. But just to reiterate, what we're really tasked to do today is to look at these measures, and we're specifically evaluating the sub-criteria as we go through each of these measures. And this is really a recommendation to the steering committee, on which I sit as well, of the four major criteria, and that's the key element of what we're going to look at here from the standpoint of making recommendations based on all these sub-criteria. So is it important to measure? Is the science there? And is it feasible and acceptable from the standpoint of the measure itself? So each of these sub-criteria we've been asked to score, and those that have reviewed your slides, you'll know that we're going to look at really a simple scoring. It's a rating scale that will ask you to evaluate each of these measures. And I know we have, Brian, you turned in your SurveyMonkey, but we'll work with the same type of scale for each of these and by consensus derive a score for each of these elements of the sub-criteria. The rating scale, just to make everybody on the same page, is we'll evaluate for complete, and that's unquestionably demonstrated to meet the criterion. P would be partially demonstrating to meet the criterion. M is minimally. It means it's addressed, but it's demonstrated only minimally meet the criterion. N is not at all, so that's a no-brainer. That makes sense. It just isn't going to go anywhere. And not applicable, obviously, if it's really only an option for a few exceptions. So we'll try and keep that focus as we go through these things and look at the four major criteria as we go forward, and then these will be recommendations that we'll take back to the subcommittee, steering committee. I will also tell you that there are elements and times for adjustments of these measures as they go forward. So as we're evaluating these measures per verbatim submission, and the owners of the measures have to modify them if they're going to go forward if we make suggestions. And we can make some suggestions back if we feel that those measures could be potentially wordsmithed to make it more appropriate. Reva, let me turn this over to you then at this point and maybe give us a little bit of an overview on the NQF.
Right. What I'd like to do is present just a brief overview of NQF and this project and how it fits into the overall NQF activities, as well as the specific review of the evaluation criteria to kind of prepare for the later discussion. I don't want to take a lot of time with this. For those of you watching the webinar, the slides are being presented. This is a slightly shorter set than was originally sent to the TAP several weeks ago. This set was sent to you last night for those of you who are not watching the webinar. So Sarah's going to help me, and you'll go to the next slide, Sarah. That's great. Our meeting goals today are to this orientation. We're going to look at the sub-criteria, and if there's time, an additional activity of this project is to look at potential gaps in outcome measures that would be desirable for topics in this area. Next slide. NQF, I think, is familiar to all of you as a private nonprofit voluntary consensus standard setting organization. We have more than 400 member organizations. Most of you are represent one or more of those organizations. We have significant involvement in the National Priorities Partnership, which I'll talk about a little bit later. Our board of directors represents the multi-stakeholder membership that we have, and the Consensus Standards Approval Committee, or the CSAC, which you'll hear us mention, is a subcommittee of the board of directors, which really acts on their behalf to go over some of the final approvals of the measures. Next slide. Our mission is three-pronged. One is around setting national goals and priorities in our partnership with the National Priorities Partners. Second is endorsing national consensus standards, and that's the work we're doing today with this project. And third is promoting national goals through education and outreach, which are some of the other activities that go on at NQF. Next slide. The growth of NQF-endorsed measures over the last decade in the 10 years of NQF's existence has had several drivers. NQF's portfolio of measures contains somewhere over 600 measures at this time. There's been a tremendous evolution in what's going on in terms of measurement, the types of measures that are important and the types of measures that are needed for a wide variety of programs. There have been measures needed for pay-for-performance programs, measures addressing important gaps where measurement had been poorly represented previously. We've done a lot of work around individual clinician-level measures, around disparity-sensitive measures, patient experience measures, and cross-county measures. As we're moving forward in reviewing the measures in the portfolio, the question always arises, you know, are there too many? Are there too few? Do we have the right measures? And on an ongoing basis, we are reviewing and maintaining the measures within the portfolio as the changing environment evolves. Availability of data sources and hopefully greater availability of information from EHRs are helping promote some of this evolution, and this is going to be a dynamic enterprise moving forward. Next slide. The evolution, as I mentioned, we hear back from our NQF members and the stakeholders. We need measures to help us drive to higher performance. There is a greater interest in composite measures, particularly around process measures, but certainly even for some of the outcome measures. Looking at disparities in everything, so as we not overlook that issue. We need to harmonize measures across sites and providers. This is an important aspect of measurement because we're finding that measures developed in different settings of care around the same topic are just enough different that it drives people in the field crazy. And so harmonization to keep the measure specifications as aligned as possible is an important priority for us. New measures we're looking for to add to the portfolio will focus on promoting shared accountability and measurement across patient-focused episodes of care, specifically around outcome measures, and that's one of the focus of this large project. We're also interested in appropriateness measures as well as cost and resource use measures that are coupled with quality to provide some information around efficiency. Next slide. Just to mention about disparities, I don't want to belabor it, but disparities are an important thing, and whenever a measure can address them, we would hope that it would. Next slide. The National Priorities Partnership I mentioned, these are overall, have identified some overarching objectives. There are six of them around patient and family engagement, population health, patient safety, care coordination, end-of-life care, and appropriate use of healthcare services. Whenever possible, we would like the measures that we endorse to feed into reaching these goals and objectives of the National Priorities Partnership. Next slide, please. This particular outcomes project is funded by the Department of Health and Human Services. Their interest is focusing on the top 20 Medicare conditions. There is a wide variation in the availability of existing outcome measures depending in this area. There are not a lot in the GI area, and we're hoping to expand NQF's current portfolio of outcome measures through this effort. Next slide. The Outcomes Project is quite large. It's had multiple phases. We've had a lot of different topic areas to include. There are 8 clinical advisory panels meeting. This is one of them. The Medicare Top 20 list includes GI topics such as cholecystitis, GERD, ulcer disease, though we are not limiting ourselves to those specific topics. When we did the call for measures for this project, we identified those areas as well as any other pertinent to the GI topic area. So as you can see, we're also looking at child health and mental health, so this is really quite a large project. Next slide. The goals for this project are twofold. One is to identify, evaluate, and endorse additional outcome measures suitable for public reporting, and that's an important thing to keep in mind. NQF is about measures that are suitable for public reporting as well as quality improvement. This project does include some cross-cutting measures that aren't specific to any particular condition, as well as the conditions we just discussed. A second equally important goal of this project is to identify gaps in existing outcome measures and recommend potential outcome measures to fill those gaps. We will probably be circling back to you via email most likely to help us work on some documents to offer some suggestions on how to fill gaps in measurement, particularly around those topic areas that are among the Medicare Top 20. Next slide, please. The project timeline, we've been working on this project since late last summer. The main steering committee met in October. We've been having TAP meetings through December through March. The main steering committee that you are advising will meet in April on the 20th and 21st here in Washington, D.C. The recommendations from that steering committee will be put together into a report that will be issued for public and member comment in June. Then we will be back to the steering committee to look at those comments, to make any revisions as necessary, and then it will go out for member voting in August. The results of the voting will be taken to the CSAC in October with board ratification to follow. So this is moving at a very quick and rapid pace. And we thank you for your participation and willingness to give your time and work with us along this fairly rapid timeline. Next slide, please. Developing consensus is what NQF does, and there is a formal process. You can see these bullets on developing consensus is important. It's a multi-stakeholder process. We have public and private sector representatives. We focus on the entire continuum of healthcare, and once endorsed, measures are then known as voluntary consensus standards. Next slide, please. This is a schematic of how that formal process works. The technical advisors or technical advisory panels are advisory to the project steering committee, which is the main decision-making body, which acts as a proxy to the NQF multi-stakeholder membership. That committee makes the draft recommendations that go out for review and comment. Those draft recommendations then go out for voting and final approval by the CSAC and Board of Directors. There is an appeals period after that as well. And these all form a process that comports with federal law that allows the federal government to use NQF-endorsed measures when they are using these type of instruments. Next slide, please. The role of the TAP in this particular project is to provide the technical input to our steering committee regarding the sub-criteria in the standard measure evaluation criteria. So we're looking for your help to really look down into the details and pull out the issues that the steering committee needs to be aware of. We hope that you'll help us identify the strengths and weaknesses of the measures and ask the pertinent questions so that all the information necessary is available for the steering committee to ultimately make their decision. The chair of all each of the TAPs sits as a voting member of the steering committee. So Dr. Johnson is also a member of the steering committee, and he will act as a facilitator in transferring the information from the TAP to the committee when these measures are discussed, as well as act as a voting member on all the measures that are presented to the steering committee. For this project, the TAP will also work with NQF staff to suggest how we might fill some of the gaps in outcome measures in some of these topic areas that are important. And we, like I say, we'll probably be doing that in some follow-up work rather than today. Next slide, please. So we are, just to clarify, today we're going to ask the TAP members to evaluate the sub-criteria. That's the 1A, B, C, and rate them to the extent to which the criteria are met and to identify the strengths and weaknesses for the steering committee. Ultimately, it will be the steering committee who makes the final evaluation on the four major criteria, the importance to measure and report, the scientific acceptability of the measure properties, usability, and feasibility, and then ultimately makes a recommendation whether a measure should go forward for endorsement. So this group is an advisory to that main committee. Next slide, please. I want to briefly review NQF's endorsement or the measure evaluation criteria and endorsement criteria. There are some fundamental conditions for consideration by NQF. NQF staff has reviewed those and identified those in the measure evaluation criteria. The four main criteria we've discussed, and then ultimately, if there are competing measures, which we do not have for this particular group of measures, though we do in some of the other topic areas, identifying a best-in-class. Endorsing multiple measures is not particularly useful for implementation in the field. Next slide, please. The evaluation criteria describe the desirable characteristics of measures for endorsement. These evaluation criteria have evolved over NQF's lifespan. However, they were most recently revised in August of 2009 by this Consensus Standards Approval Committee. The goal of that revision was to raise the bar on the measures that NQF endorses and try and really identify the desirable characteristics of those measures. There is a hierarchy and a rationale to the measure evaluation criteria. The importance criteria is that the steering committee will ultimately decide on is important to measure those aspects with greatest potential for driving improvements. Because ultimately, we're talking about a cost-benefit analysis. If the information obtained from the measure is not important, then it is probably not worth the cost of trying to implement the measure. And regardless of how good the measure is in terms of reliability, validity, and scientific precision, if it isn't important, it probably isn't worth the cost either. So importance is the first level in the hierarchy. Second is scientific acceptability, and by this we are looking at the measure itself and its properties. Whether this measure as a tool to make valid conclusions about quality is acceptable and appropriate. The third one is usable. Is the information obtained from the measure useful to members and the public at large? In order to be usable, it will certainly have to be valid and reliable. And then feasibility is how easy is it to implement, what will be the cost, what will be the burden, and ideally we would like measures that cause as little burden as possible. So we want the largest bang for our buck. So this is the evaluation criteria, and I want to go into them just very, very briefly in a little bit of detail. Next. Next slide. Sarah. Hello? Sarah, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here. Which number did you want to go to?
19.
Got it.
don't have it.
You don't have 19 up?
I saw it.
I don't.
It's not on the screen anymore?
19.
It's on our
I see 19.
Oh, well, okay. For whatever reason, I'm not, so.
Yeah, it's on 19.
It's on 18. I don't understand.
Titled Evaluation Criteria?
Hold on a sec. My apologies. Okay. The evaluation criteria, the sub-criteria delineate how to demonstrate the measure criteria. So that's why it's very important for the work that you're going to do today to really help us understand how to evaluate these measures. These criteria parallel the best practices for measure development, and most criteria and sub-criteria involve a matter of degree rather than all or nothing. That's why the rating scale is a scale and isn't a yes or no. The rating scale, as we mentioned, is a scale from completely meets the criteria through partially, minimally, or not at all. Occasionally not applicable is appropriate depending on the sub-criteria. Importance to measure and report, I don't want to belabor this, but we are looking for the sub-criteria around this is having a high impact or does it meet an MPP goal. Secondly, whether there is a gap in performance. In other words, is there an opportunity to drive improvement in performance or not? And C is the evidence that supports the measure focus. In other words, if the measure is about a certain process of care, what is the evidence behind it? What is the level of evidence? And what is the relationship to outcomes? For this particular project, we are talking about outcomes, so essentially, that is almost a given criteria because we are so much focused on outcomes. However, the measure developers have given a lot of information in terms of the importance of the outcome measure in terms of actionability that you can consider. The next slide. In terms of evidence, just basic guidance, we do ask that the evidence underlying a measure is graded using the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force grading system whenever possible. And then for outcomes, that it's relevant to a goal or condition, also whether it's actionable and can be improved. Next slide. Scientific acceptability of the measure properties is the extent to which the measure, as specified, produces consistent and credible results about the quality of care. And so this is where we're going to get into the nuts and bolts about the measure. But please keep in mind that scientific acceptability is not about the evidence. This is about the measure. Next slide. Precise specifications are important. Do we have all the details? Do we have all the definitions? Is it specified sufficiently so that it's that it would be implemented in a standard way? Reliability and validity are important. We would hope that all measures have had some assessment or testing around reliability and validity. Reliability referring to the extent to which the measurement is reproducible and repeatable. Validity referring to the extent to which the measure achieves the purpose for which is it intended. I mean, did you measure what you wanted to measure? So reliability and validity are very important criteria. These are not all or none properties, but they're a matter of degree. There, I'm on slide 26.
Yes.
Okay, great. They're not static. They can vary with different conditions, but in order to be valid, a measure must be reliable, but reliability is not guaranteed validity. So they're very closely related, but they are different. Because we want to use measurement for driving improvement in performance, we'd like to know the ability of a measure for discriminating performance. Is it able to identify outliers or good versus poor performance? So that will be one of the important criteria. Next slide, usability. The extent to which intended audience can understand the results and are likely to find them useful, sort of basic. So this is also where harmonization comes in or where distinctive and added value to our existing portfolio is important. We'd want to be sure that the measures we endorse have a high likelihood of being implemented in the field. Harmonization, just to go back, is where the specifications are aligned regardless of the setting, regardless of the measure developer, regardless of how they've been used in the past. All measures about beta blocker use in patients with coronary artery disease should have basically the same set of specifications and exclusions and inclusion criteria to make it more likely to be implemented across settings of care in a standardized fashion. Next slide is feasibility. This is, again, how easy will it be for a patient? How is the data generated? Are the sources electronic? Are additional data sources needed for the exclusions? Do we know how susceptible to inaccuracies or errors the data will be? And then how is the data collection strategy implemented? So feasibility is all about how much will it cost to do it. Keeping an eye on the clock, I really would like to just skip these last couple and get started on talking about the measures. So does anybody have any questions about the measure evaluation criteria first?
This is Karen Hall. I have one question. If the submitted form doesn't have any information on it about those areas, are we supposed to come up with our best answer for that, or?
Yeah, I mean, when measures are submitted, there is a responsibility of the developer to provide us with the information it will take to evaluate the measure. If you have insufficient information, I think it's fine to just say so, and you won't be able to rate it. If you do have information around some of the criteria, that would be fine. Are there any other questions? Okay. David, I think we might as well just launch into the measures.
Well, thanks, Reba. Just one or two things to add to the discussion here. In particular, when we talk about looking at these measures, they're all about quality. So there's no intent other than to bring good to our patients by introducing these measures. So recognize that on the global sense of everything looks good on paper for quality, we need to recognize in particular some of the disparities of what these measures might bring to our patients and our members. So looking at in particular some of the downstream consequences of putting a measure forward that may not measure exactly what it is supposed to do, there is a strong undercurrent on a lot of these measures about referral bias and the potential shifting of patients and stratification for demographic mix. So we just need to consider all those things as we go forward, recognizing on the global good side, we can actually do harm if these measures are not appropriately risk-adjusted and stratified and really to look at what we're trying to accomplish is a betterment rather than potentially create harm. So that's the entry criteria of discussion. What I thought we would do is, and I've assigned each of you as a champion for each of the five measures, and I'm going to ask that
Excuse me?
Yes.
Hello? Hi. I'm sorry to interrupt. This is Dr. Bruce Hall. I'm representing the American College of Surgeons.
Okay, Bruce, you're the measure developer? Great.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I've been on the call since the start, but I guess you had me on a line where you couldn't hear me speak.
Okay. That's great. I think, Bruce, your measure will be towards the end of the list, those, but thanks for being here.
Okay. I apologize for interrupting. I just wanted to see if I was on a good line. Thank you.
The way that I'd like to structure this with a discussion of each of the champions presenting an overview of the measure, and I'm going to ask you to give us your kind of 30,000-foot view, but then to walk us through each of the points and for you to give a grade for each of these, and then after you provide your recommendation to the rest of the steering committee here, to the TAP, then we'll open it up for discussion on each of the points and then see if we by consensus can come to a final vote, if you will, on each of the the measures as presented. So we'll go through this, and therefore these four major criteria that will be indelibly ingrained in your memory as far as importance to measure, the scientific acceptability, usability, and feasibility. We'll take those in sequence. So the first measure, Brian, I'm going to ask you to do that, and Dick, I realize you have the 30-day measure. So let's. I think we may accomplish a lot on the first measure that will be somewhat redundant. We can go a little bit more quickly through the second with the 30-day. But Brian, I'll ask if you would walk us through the 180-day measure, introduce what the measure is, and the both bariatrics measures are submitted by Ingenix. And then to walk us through afterwards, I'm going to take you to the report, and then go through each of the four major criteria for us.
Okay. So, as Dave said, this is a measure developed by Ingenix, which is my understanding is a company that helps with measure development, improving quality. It's basically a consulting group that works on a lot of areas in the forefront of this field, like electronic health records and things like that. So this is not a company that, to my knowledge, makes products used in bariatric surgery and might thus have a major conflict. This is an outcome measure specifically looking at safety, which is one of the NQF's priority areas is patient safety, although it doesn't address one of the national priority goals. There's no specific goal other than improving safety, but it is a priority area. And it looks at all patients age 12 and over who are undergoing bariatric surgery, and it's there in the denominator with really no exclusions that I could identify. And then looking for complications, and there's a listing we'll get to later as I go through this that defines what a complication is. And then the time frame to look at this is 180 days after the procedure, after the bariatric surgery is done, and it looks like it's meant to be used in a 2-year window so that you would look over a 24-month period and look at all those who had had surgery in that time frame. And it's really meant to be used for all the purposes of a measure, quality, assurance, public reporting, and all of those sorts of things. They state that it has been fully developed and tested, and we'll go through that as well. So getting on to the first section, just the importance, is this important to measure and report?
Brian, maybe can I just interrupt you? Just what I'd like to do is have you each person give an overview, and then just make sure that the TAP doesn't have any questions on the overview, and then we'll walk through. Just you did an excellent job, but maybe if we could just use that as process.
Sure. Any questions on the overview? Okay. So getting into the first section, the importance to measure and report. They do provide evidence that there is a reasonably high complication rate from bariatric surgery. I think most of us who see these patients recognize why. It's a fairly high-risk patient population to begin with because of generally morbid obesity and often comorbidity such as diabetes that's complicated. So there is background evidence showing that there is a high complication rate, both for the 30-day time frame and a 180-day time frame. These are rates that range from 10% to up to 40%. And it appears over time some of these complication rates have been getting better, suggesting that quality improvement or attention to this could improve outcomes in terms of safety. Remember, recognizing that bariatric surgery, the outcome is twofold, is really the purpose is to lose weight and to end up being healthier. But you could argue that if there's major complications associated with it, that those goals may not, that outcome of truly losing weight may not be as important. There really has not been a look at 180-day risks in many surveys, so that's, I think, part of the rationale for doing this, to say, look, typically we look at 30-day complication rates for surgery, but in this patient population, there are delayed complications, and no one has a good experience in knowing what those are and how those could be improved. There was a study that they do cite where this 180-day time frame was looked at, and found that there were still significant complication rates, but that there could also be decline in that rate. Although they do say that in that 180-day, a lot of the improvements seen over time was actually in the early initial hospital stay time frame, and not as much over the ensuing months. So I guess I have to now rate 1A in terms of impact. Right, Dave?
Yes, please.
So, you know, I would give this a P as a partial. It's not complete, only because I don't think there's a lot of data to talk about the 180-day time frame, but there is some information about that.
Okay.
Any questions there? Do you want everyone to give consensus before we move on?
I think that would be just to keep it really kind of focused and easy. We don't drift apart from our mission here. Well, let's just go through the recommendation for partial here. Any discussion on that, and any other thoughts?
This is John Allen. I think the impact potentially is high, but I think the complexity reduces it a little bit. So I guess I would agree with Brian with a P.
Any other comments?
This is Dick Johannes. I would just comment that one advantage of the 180-day look back is that it gives an opportunity for readmission to be considered as a potential, as part of the outcome measure, which a shorter time frame doesn't really allow.
Yeah, okay. This is Brian again. I think one of the things that I'm struck by is, you know, as a gastroenterologist, we often see complications that are sort of delayed complications, anastomotic strictures, fistulas, let's say in a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, fistulas back to the bypass stomach. So I think those are important complications, and those, you're right, Dick, those will not be necessarily captured in the short time frame. I think when we get to the specifics of numerator, we'll have to look to see if all of those are included in there, or if it's really more of a focus on some of the larger sort of the obvious surgical complications, such as a bowel obstruction or wound dehiscence and things like that.
Any other discussions or recommendations beyond partial for the impact 1A? Hey, Brian, how about gaps, opportunities for improvement?
Right, opportunities. So they provide evidence here looking at a very large database. One of the things that NGINX has done is they've got a lot of measures, and they have a testing database that they can use that has a diverse commercial population, generally not Medicare age. They're less than 65 years of age, but they can use this to test reliability and validity of the measures that they develop. They've looked here just to get a baseline as a complication rate, and using this the measure criteria, they found a rate of about 18% of complications. So this is a fairly high complication rate after bariatric surgery. It's an overall rate. They did not break it down by geographic region to see that that you're seeing actual differences in the United States. In terms of improvement, I think an 18% complication rate probably has room for improvement, I think, just simply because it's very high. Again, I would give this a partial only because I don't think it's complete, because we don't know that there's testing showing that if you use this measure, you can affect that number at the 180-day rate. But I think it just providing that baseline number and it being so high is very high. If it was a very, and what I mean by is if it was a very small complication rate, I think the room for improvement would be low. I doubt you could go from 1% to 0.5%. But at 20%, I think there is a real opportunity for improvement.
Excellent. Okay, so the recommendation for partial discussion on that point for opportunity for improvement.
Again, this is Dick Johannes. The only place I might suggest some opportunity for improvement would be in the argument that no risk adjustment is necessary. It would seem that with something with complication rate in the mid-teens, that the particular types of patients coming to bariatric surgery may vary. And they may vary systematically at some level across provider and provider organizations. And it strikes me that some level of stratification or risk adjustment might be necessary. Now, how one would do that is another entire question. But I think to say that you could report the rates without risk adjustment, I'm not sure let me say this. I think that represents a gap.
Yeah, I would agree entirely on that. In particular, as you start to drift to referral biases and shifting patients to more complicated patients away from your center. So you would still support partial, though, Dick, and that was just a suggestion for gaps for improvement.
Yep.
Okay. Any other comments?
This is okay, Karen Hall.
Oh, I'm sorry, Karen.
Yeah. Was there any assessment of mobility pre-op in these patients? Because talking about risk factors, I guess that could be considered one. So was this measure focusing on preoperative measures that would impact their rehab, for instance?
Yep.
That's not provided in the information packet we have. There is not really any risk stratification. I can jump ahead, but there's really no risk adjustments that are made. There's nothing about disparities in care. And one of the nice things is that there really aren't a lot of exclusions, which makes it, I think, easier when you implement a measure if you're not having to worry about exclusion criteria. But yeah, there's nothing that I can find about that.
Because I think we're starting to blend some of the scientific acceptability with the importance to measure. I think. Let's keep it just focused on the first importance to measure and report. So, Karen, I agree with you 100%, and Dick kind of echoed some of those comments about risk adjustment, but I think they'll come up again as we talk about scientific acceptability. So, Brian, from the standpoint of gaps for improvement, I think we're in consensus that partial would be the way that we would agree with you. In relation to outcomes?
So this is outcome or evidence that supports this measure focus. In other words, should this just be a measure that looks at, why don't we just have one harmonized measure that looks at 180-day complication rate for surgery? Why does it have to be bariatric surgery specifically? Mm-hmm. And I think they provide evidence that this is a very morbid procedure. There are a number of very serious or life-threatening complications that you might see here where you might not see after maybe some more minor types of surgeries. They feel the measure will be useful to identify specifically surgeons and the centers where bariatric surgery is being performed, which more and more are really, I think what they want to do is try to find centers of excellence or at least help those where they're having high problems with this fix what may be a higher complication rate. Because I think bariatric patients would like to seek out centers of excellence with lower complication rates. Also, they feel it's important to identify any regional differences. I suppose this is maybe helpful. I don't know enough to say. Maybe Dr. Riccardi would comment, but there may be regional differences in the types of surgeries that are being performed. There may be more lap band done in the Midwest versus Roux and Y in the Northeast or something like that. It also would help to identify high-risk patients. So there may be certain patient subsets who may benefit more if you can pinpoint that, let's say, those with longstanding diabetes seem to have higher complication rates, maybe they would be appropriate for disease management type services that are as they go through the process. The problem here is I don't believe those are that information is captured in the measure. So, and we'll talk. We can get to that later. And then I think an important part is whether there needs to be a 180-day time frame. We'll talk about 30-day with Dick afterwards, but they feel that there is tremendous value for identifying complications later on, mainly because they think there may be different patterns or the types of complications that occur later. And I would concur with this. I think that is true. As I said, we see in GI, we see a lot of complications later, although I don't know that all the ones that we see that fall into the delayed complications, such as just simple abdominal pain and nausea, are really part of this measure. And then just in terms of, I think also part of this is strength of evidence. They do show really through observational studies. There's no USPS task force in terms of grading for the degree of evidence that's provided, but it's all done through observational study. There's nothing randomized to show this. Observational studies do show that there can be improvements made, even in 180-day complication rates that appear to be associated with techniques such as laparoscopy, and importantly with hospital volume in terms of numbers of cases that are done seem to have a lower rate, although there's not an intervention to show that this measure changes that complication rate. So I think here I would give a partial score as well, not complete, again, just because of the strength of evidence being observational without any study using this prospectively to measure true decline in complication rates.
Okay. How about this, Dave, again, comments for or questions for Brian as it relates to relation to outcomes. Brian, one thing, this is Dave again, would just reiterate is why I would think partial is appropriate, because the measure is it looks at defining centers of excellence. It doesn't allow us capture of drift through different systems, how at 180 days the complications are going to be captured unless it comes back to that individual hospital. How these are qualified and standardized is another gap as it relates to reporting bias potential. So I would agree with that, and I think it has some opportunities for identifying gaps for improvement as it relates to outcome, is how these are all standardized and capture. More sophisticated centers would have a better capture rate. If you were a tertiary referral center and you did the operation 180 days later, they're back in even a different state, their complications may not be as facile for being captured. Reporting biases, how complications are managed across these measures is also a question I had as far as inpatient, outpatient, ED or urgent care center. So I still think that's a relative gap as you start to look at the relation to outcomes here.
David, this is John.
Yeah.
The way NGenics works is it contracts with, it's actually a sub-division of United Healthcare, but contracts independently with many of the major payers. And so this would be based on claims data, which for which they would gather together a claims data set. They combine claims, pharmacy, lab, et cetera, into the NGenics database, and they've created episodes of care. So I think that one of the strengths of a company like that, and it's not only NGenics but others, is that they can capture longitudinal things. So it wouldn't actually be based on data coming from the particular center that did the bariatric surgery. So I think that in some ways that could be constructed.
Yeah. This is Dick Johannes. I agree. That's actually one of the potential upsides, is that by using closed claim data sets, you could in fact look at readmission, which if you used hospital center based data collection, you could only look at same hospital or same institution readmission rates, and that's a plus, I think, of the 180-day measure.
One final comment. Again, a claims-based database is always subject to lots of issues that are separate from today's discussion, but one of the other complications that as we look at outcomes for virtually any abdominal surgery is hernia, and I'm not sure how that would be captured and reported if they were monitoring this as a complication. We'll talk about scientific acceptability and how these complications are defined, but that would be another one that might be lost if you're looking at extended follow-up, but still complications that are pretty common in this population. So, Brian, I think you had a consensus, I think, that partial was the relation to outcomes. How about we move to scientific acceptability?